Thank you, Mr. Gines. Good afternoon, or good morning. I'm used to good afternoon at home. Good morning. Happy Sabbath to you. Yes, it isn't raining for the first time in at least a couple years since we've been here. It's every single time. Liz actually drove most of the way today, so maybe that's it. God pours rain on me, but he lets Liz drive in the nice weather. But maybe she should always drive. This coming week, most Americans are going to take part in two traditions, whether or not they realize it. The first happens late tonight, early tomorrow morning. We all lose an hour. One of the very few constants in life, time, will be arbitrarily adjusted. Why? Well, because we were told to, and because we did it last year, and the year before that, and the year before that, and the 100 or so years before that. But why? Does anyone in here enjoy springing forward and losing an hour of sleep tonight? Why do we do it? This is from timeanddate.com. In July 1908, Thunder Bay in Ontario, Canada, became the first location to use daylight savings time, or DST. Other locations in Canada were also early to introduce daylight savings bylaws. Germany became the first country as a whole to introduce DST when clocks were turned ahead 1 hour on April 30th, 1916. The rationale was to minimize the use of artificial lighting in order to save fuel during the war effort of World War I. The idea was quickly followed by the United Kingdom and many other countries, including France. Many countries reverted back to standard time after World War I, and it wasn't until the next World War, many years later, of course, that DST made its return to most of Europe. American inventor and politician Benjamin Franklin wrote an essay called An Economical Project for Diminishing the Cost of Light to the editor of the Journal of Paris, even back in 1784. In the essay, he suggested, although jokingly, that Parisians could economize candle usage by getting people out of bed earlier in the morning, making use of the natural morning light instead. So from 1945 to 1966, there were no uniform rules for daylight savings time in the U.S., and this caused widespread confusion, especially for trains, buses, and the broadcasting industry. As a result, the Uniform Time Act of 1966 was established by Congress. It stated that daylight savings time would begin on the last Sunday of April and end on the last Sunday of October. However, states still had the ability to be exempt from that by passing a state ordinance if they wanted to. Congress extended daylight savings time to a period of 10 months in 1974 and 8 months in 1975 in hopes to save energy following the 1973 oil embargo. The trial period showed that daylight savings time saved the energy equivalent of 10,000 barrels of oil each day. But it still was controversial. Many complained that the dark winter mornings endangered the lives of children who were going to school. After the energy crisis was over in 1976, daylight saving time schedule in the U.S. was revised several times throughout the year. We couldn't make up our minds on what to stick with. So from 1987 to 2006, the country observed it for about 7 months each year. The current schedule was introduced in 2007 and follows another act, the Energy Policy Act of 2005, which extended it by another month. And this is getting repetitive and boring at this point, but some like to hear the history behind that. Today, it starts on the second Sunday in March, and it ends, as you know, tomorrow. It's now in use over 70 countries worldwide, and it affects a billion people every year. The beginning and end dates vary from one country to another. But whether or not you enjoy daylight savings time, it was a tradition of man started for a specific purpose. However, even once that purpose went away, the tradition continues. Why is it that we change what time we say it is instead of just getting up earlier when the sun comes up earlier? Perhaps it's a tradition that we've fallen into. The second tradition coming at this the coming week, on Wednesday actually, is St. Patrick's Day, which you may or may not have realized based on how much you go out in public at this point. This information is from timemagazine.com. The tradition goes back all the way to St. Patrick, who is credited with bringing Catholicism to Ireland. For centuries, his memory was honored with a feast and a trip to church. Was it like that now? St. Patrick's story begins as a young man in the 5th century, when at age 16 he was kidnapped from his British home by Irish raiders and taken as a slave to Gaelic Ireland. But while captive in Ireland, working as a shepherd, Patrick, quote-unquote, found God, who instructed him to escape to the Irish coast, where a ship would be waiting for him to ferry home. So he became a Catholic priest due to this act, and he eventually returned to Ireland, where he spent much of the rest of his life proselytizing to pagan Irishmen. You may wonder why the shamrock is so deeply associated with the holiday. It's because in his missionary work, St. Patrick supposedly used the clover to explain the Trinity. So the day remained a primarily religious occasion, at least through the start of the 20th century, when Ireland, in a show of patriotism for him, added an annual military parade that ran through the streets of Dublin, Ireland's capital. But it's not until about the 1960s that the parade was transformed into more of a spectacle, primarily meant to entertain. The day was really popularized by Irish Americans wanting to party more than the Irish nation itself. Because it's a fun day of drinking and debauchery, it has now worked itself into mainstream America. We seem to do that very well. Let's look at four traditions of St. Patrick's Day before we move on to the Bible, more importantly. First tradition is eating corned beef and cabbage. What's that come from? This is actually more of an American tradition than Irish. It dates back to the 19th century, when most Irish Americans were poor and could only afford the cheapest meat possible, corned beef. As for cabbage, it's likely just because it's a spring vegetable. What about drowning the shamrock? Have you heard of that with St. Patrick's Day? Simply place a clover at the bottom of your cup, fill it up with Guinness or Irish whiskey, and drink up. It's up to you whether you like to eat the shamrock or chuck it over your shoulder at the end for good luck. Again, the shamrock represents the false trinity. Wearing green. This green association is actually kind of a fluke. The original color for St. Patrick's Day was blue, but for several reasons, green prevailed. Ireland's often referred to as the Emerald Isle, and its flag displays a green stripe, as many of you probably know. But of course, shamrocks are green, which gave the color another advantage over blue, but that became a St. Patrick's tradition. And finally, the dumbest one of all, pinching others when you're not wearing green. Rumor has it that leprechauns, who are most often imagined wearing green get-ups, pinch those around them who are not supporting their green apparel. That has evolved into humans pinching each other to display the disapproval we think the leprechauns would be showing. Those of you who've worked in offices, you've seen grown men and women pinching each other because they're not wearing the collar green. It's absolutely ridiculous. But many people around us are slaves to traditions. It's completely normal to them. They never step back and think, why am I doing what I'm doing? But it's fun, so who cares? Well, do you and I fall prey to that same kind of thinking? Are you a slave to any of your own traditions? Let's examine some examples of those who were slaves to tradition. Let's start back in 1 Samuel chapter 2, if you'll turn back there. This will be 1 Samuel 2. We'll start in verse 12. Read a few verses here. Eli, of course, was the priest in the tabernacle of God at the time. 1 Samuel 2 and verse 12. Now the sons of Eli were corrupt. They did not know the Lord. And the priest's custom with the people was that when any man offered a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come with a three-pronged flesh hook in his hand while the meat was boiling. Then he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot, and the priest would take for himself all that the flesh hook brought up. So they did in Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Also, before they burned the fat, the priest's servants would come and say to the man who sacrificed, "Give meat for roasting to the priest, for he will not take boiled meat from you, but raw." And if the man said to him, "They should really burn the fat first, then you may take as much as your heart desires." He would then answer him, "No, but you must give it now, and if not, I will take it by force." Therefore, the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for men abhorred the offering of the Lord based on their actions. Eli's sons were making a mockery of God. They ignored the instructions from God and kept their own traditions, as we just read about, and they sought their own desires. Let's drop down to verse 22. Now Eli was very old, and he heard everything his sons did to all of Israel. how they lay with the women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the meeting. So he said to them, "Why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people." "No, my sons, for it is not a good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people transgress. If one man sins against another, God will judge him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who will intercede for him?" Nevertheless, they did not heed the voice of their father, because the Lord desired to kill them. Again, they are ignoring God's instructions and keeping their own traditions instead. Let's drop down to verse 34. "Now this shall be a sign to you that will come upon you and your two sons, on Hophni and Phinehas. In one day they shall die, both of them. Then I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind, and I will build him a sure house, and he shall walk before my anointed forever." So Eli's sons were not worthy to be priests, so Samuel would be taking their place, as you probably know the story, instead. Let's continue on here. Let's go to chapter 3 and verse 12. I'm trying to shorten this a bit. You can go back and read all more in context if you wish later. Chapter 3 and verse 12. "In that day I will perform against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile and he did not restrain them. And therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever." So Eli had talked to his sons about their behavior. He knew that it was wrong. But he didn't restrain them. He didn't make them change their ways. He didn't force them to change the traditions they were keeping for themselves. The Israelites were fighting against the Philistines at this time and losing. So they decided to bring the Ark of the Covenant to them to help them. But the traditions they were keeping weren't godly. So let's see what happens. Chapter 4 and verse 10. "So the Philistines fought," this is 1 Samuel 4 and verse 10, "and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent. There was a very great slaughter, and there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. Also the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died, just as God said they would." Verse 12, "Then a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line the same day and came to Shiloh with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. Now when he came, there was Eli sitting on a seat by the wayside watching, for his heart trembled for the Ark of God. And when the man came into the city and told it, all the city cried out. When Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, 'What does the sound of this tumult mean?' And the man came quickly and told Eli. Eli was 98 years old, and so his eyes were so dim that he could not see. Then the man said to Eli, 'I am he who came from the battle, and I fled today from the battle line.' And he said, 'What happened, my son?' So the messenger answered and said, 'Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has been a great slaughter among the people. Also your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured.' Then it happened, when he had made mention of the Ark of God, that Eli fell off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. For the man was old and heavy, and he had judged Israel 40 years. The sons of Eli were going through motions only. They were happy choosing their own traditions, seeking their own desires rather than obeying God. And Eli allowed this to happen because they were his sons. He probably treated them differently than he would have someone else if they were doing the same thing. Both Eli and his sons knew better, but they were happy to keep traditions that they wanted to. And we just read the end there, in the Old Testament time and age, they were killed for their sinful ways and traditions. Let's notice next the example of Mary and Margaret. If you'll turn over to Luke 10. Luke 10 and verse 38. Now, some traditions are good. I don't want to come across as saying any tradition is bad, of course. There are family traditions that are very healthy and good. Traditions, more importantly, established by God, are obviously holy and important. But what if we're slaves to traditions that distract us from those greater pursuits? What if we allow a tradition to take away from a spiritual opportunity that presents itself before us? Luke 10 and verse 38, familiar story here. Not familiar enough that I can't find it quite yet. There we go. Luke 10, 38. Now it happened as they went that he entered a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, who also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. But Martha was distracted with much serving, and she approached him and said, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Therefore, tell her to help me." And Jesus answered and said to her, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and troubled about many things, but only one thing is needed. And Mary has chosen that good part, which will not be taken away from her." So Martha's tradition was to serve when there was a need. And that's a great tradition, a great thing to do. But she missed out on a greater opportunity right before her to sit and learn at the feet of Christ. Do you find yourself sometimes zoning out during a sermon because you're thinking about things you have to do later that night or the next day? Can we busy ourselves to the point of missing out on spiritual opportunities, on missing out on that good part that we just read, which cannot be taken from us? Becoming a slave to tradition isn't something that only happens to the wicked or only happens to weak individuals. As I've contemplated personally what traditions I'm a slave to this past week, far greater men than I have fought these same battles. We all fight it. Let's look at a final example before we move on to application in our lives. Let's go to Acts 10, if you would. Read a few verses here in Acts 10, starting in verse 24. Acts 10 and verse 24. And the following day they entered Caesarea. Now Cornelius was waiting for them and had called together his relatives and close friends. As Peter was coming in, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter lifted him up, saying, "Stand up, I myself am also a man." And as he talked with them, he went and found many who had come together. Then he said to them, "You know how unlawful it is for a Jewish man to keep company with or go to one of another nation, but God has shown me that I should not call any man common or unclean. Therefore I came without objection as soon as I was sent for. I asked then, 'For what reason have you sent for me?' So Cornelius said, 4 days ago I was fasting until this hour, and at the ninth hour I prayed in my house, and behold, a man stood before me in bright clothing, and said, 'Cornelius, your prayer has been heard, and your alms are remembered in the sight of God.'" Point of reading that there, that section there, is by tradition, the Jews thought that they were better than everyone else. They didn't believe that Gentiles could even be called by God. Peter himself was a slave to this tradition. Apostles of Christ could not understand this basic truth because they were slaves to that tradition that they understood. We can confirm that Peter was a slave to that line of thinking over in Galatians 2. Galatians 2. Read verses 11 to 13 here. Galatians 2 and verse 11. "Now when Peter had come to Antioch, I withstood him to his face because he was to be blamed, as I referenced before. For before certain men came from James, he would eat with the Gentiles, but when they came, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing those who were of the circumcision, fearing how he looked to others. And the rest of the Jews also played the hypocrite with him, so that even Barnabas was carried away with their hypocrisy." Peter had to overcome the traditions that he was a slave to. He required God's guidance to open his eyes to some myopic ways of thinking that he was doing. So what are you a slave to? The internet? Your TV? Your career? Going out with friends back when we used to do that? Making money? The NCAA tournament? That one's for me. A big house? Your iPhone? Being liked? The list can go on and on. What are you and I slaves to? Go over to 1 Peter chapter 1. First Peter 1 and verse 17. We'll read verses 17 and 18. First Peter 1, verse 17. And if you call on the Father, who without partiality judges according to each one's work, conduct yourselves throughout the time of your stay here in fear, knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold, from your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers. Aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers. If that isn't describing the absurdity of what St. Patrick's Day now is, I don't know what is. But how many of my traditions, how many of your traditions, things you do all the time, your habits, how many of those are truly aimless or pointless, if you give it some thought? This is from Adam Clark's commentary. The Jews had innumerable burdens of empty ceremonies and useless ordinances, which they received by tradition from their fathers, rabbis, or doctors. The Gentiles were not less encumbered with such than the Jews. All were wedded to their vanities because they received them from their forefathers, as they had done from theirs. And this antiquity and tradition have been the groundwork of many a vain ceremony and idle pilgrimage, and of numerous doctrines which have nothing to plead in their behalf but mere antiquity. But such persons seem not to consider that error and sin are nearly coeval with the world itself. That's the end of that quote there. People just don't care anymore. You know, the work of the church in years past was to bring the truth to the people, take off the blinders of what traditions have told us for years. But now, in the information age with the internet, people know that St. Paddy's Day is pagan. They know the origins of Christmas, Easter. They don't care. They don't care at all. They know the Sabbath is the seventh day of the week. They don't care. Going on Sunday morning is more convenient to their schedule. They like getting presents for Christmas, so they keep keeping it, despite knowing much more than we have in the past. That's what their parents did, so that's what they do. Let's go over to 2 Thessalonians. Going the wrong way. 2 Thessalonians. Chapter 3, read a few of the first, actually the first six verses here, 2 Thessalonians 3. In verse 1, finally, brethren, pray for us that the word of the Lord may run swiftly and be glorified just as it is with you, and that we may be delivered from unreasonable and wicked men, for not all have faith. But the Lord is faithful, who will establish you and guard you from the evil one. And we have confidence in the Lord concerning you, both that you do and will do the things which we command you. Now may the Lord direct your hearts into the love of God and into the patience of Christ. But we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly and not according to the tradition which he received from us. So we are to distance ourselves from those who revel in man's traditions. We are inevitably pulled down into those snares if we don't withdraw from them. Peer pressure is a powerful thing. It's not always easy to withdraw ourselves from those who we've been around, possibly our entire lives. But this might include members of our own family, our own closest lifelong friends, being angry with us. Many of you have probably experienced that. And it's uncomfortable. But we may have to sacrifice relationships that we hold dear. We may physically have to put ourselves on an island. Sometimes that's what's required. Let's go over to the most obvious place concerning being slaves to tradition in Mark chapter 7. Mark chapter 7. Read verses 3 to 13. It's reading bigger chunks of scripture than normal, but at least for me. Mark 7 and verse 3. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands in a special way, holding the tradition of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other things which they have received and hold, like the washing of cups, pitchers, copper vessels, and couches. Then the Pharisees and scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat bread with unwashed hands?" He answered and said to them, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, 'The people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.' For laying aside the commandments of God, you hold the tradition of men, the washing of pitchers and cups and many other such things you do." He said to them, "All too well you reject the commandment of God that you may keep your tradition." Yeah, I'm going to read down through verse 13. "For Moses said, 'Honor your father and your mother, and he who curses his father or mother, let him be put to death.' But you say, 'If a man says to his father or mother, whatever profit you might have received from me is Corban, that is, a gift to God, then you no longer let him do anything for his father or his mother, making the word of God of no effect through your tradition, which you have handed down, and many such things you do." It's easy to think that those scribes, those Pharisees, what a train wreck. Christ candidly points out what seems very obvious to us now, but at the time, this was an eye-opening revelation that they were slaves to their own traditions. As we examine ourselves nearing Passover, it's pretty easy for me to realize I do the exact same thing, just different situations. It's got a couple of verses left before wind down here. Go over to Colossians 2 and verse 8. Colossians 2 and verse 8. "Beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world, and not according to Christ." Satan will use whatever method he can to pull us away from the truth. Anything but the truth. And mankind loves his own philosophy, loves to think he himself is the smartest man in the room. I remember my philosophy 301 class in college, which is now 20 years ago, which is weird to say. It was such a waste of time, and I did terribly in it. You weren't allowed to give a real answer. Every answer you submitted in class or on a test, you had to just ask more questions. The more you could loop around, waste time and words, and not actually answer anything, the better grade you got. It was crazy to me. This world wants anything but the truth, anything but this is right and this is wrong. This is from Barnes' notes. "There appear to have been two sources of danger to which the Colossian Christians were exposed and to which the apostle in the cautions alludes. The one was arising from Grecian philosophy, the other from Jewish opinions. The latter is what he refers to here. The Jews depended much on tradition, and many of those traditions would have tended much to corrupt the gospel of Christ." So we must ensure that we keep the right traditions, the worthy, the noble, the true traditions started by the Father and through Christ given to the church. We must root out and remove those traditions that are aimless conduct, those traditions that have been handed down for the wrong reasons, for fun, for debauchery, for pleasure. Final verse in 1 Corinthians 11. We'll just read the first two verses. "Imitate me, just as I also imitate Christ. Now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things, and keep the traditions just as I delivered them to you." Eli's sons were slaves to man's traditions. Martha was a slave to tradition. The scribes were slaves to traditions. Even Peter, at times, was a slave to tradition. The people in the world around you and I are slaves to tradition. I challenge you to ask yourself, am I any different?